Good morning, all. You're listening from your workshop, your kitchen, or your rooftop, from the kids' room, from the flatmates, or your dear friends. You have contracted COVID, or you have not. You find jury futile or profound. Welcome. After examining jury practices, Bijou contemporary practices put to the test of their discourse in 2013, and the role of ornaments in the fuzzy, the fake, the double, trouble in ornaments in 2017, La Garantie Association pour le Bijou wishes to investigate how we meet and learn with objects themselves. So today is the first of five conversations, some in French, some in English, from a range of disciplines, jewelry making, archaeological studies, design and craft history. Though all the conversations fall near the field of material cultural studies, a branch of ethnography that seeks to derive an understanding of societies through the objects and buildings that they make, we're interested in the different methods our guests will invoke. And so the series is called Parcours Bijoux, a citywide online and in real life series of events around contemporary jewelry. And this is the first time that La Garantie is organizing radio. Oh, we're having some interesting sound problems. Let's see whether that gets better. So I was saying that this is the first time we do radio broadcast. And there's something a little bit sort of counterintuitive in speaking about learning with objects at a remote. And this is both risky, but also very exciting, because I think after the pandemic and confinement, there's a sort of renewed desire to meet with objects and people. And so we're going to try to see how we can sort of, with Rita Wilkinson today, discuss how in the context of objects, we can learn something. I want to welcome Arita. She's our first guest. And I'm going to start with a small biography, Arita, if you don't mind. You're a jeweler of Maori descent. You hold a PhD in creative arts from Massey University. And you have a past life in tertiary education as a design tutor at Unitech New Zealand. You have 30 years of jewelry making, of exploring wakapaipai concepts of Maori personal adornment in the context of bicultural New Zealand. Your recent work represents an ongoing investigation into the history of Maori wearable taonga, or prized possessions, particularly relevant to your iwi community in Te Waipunamu, the South Island where you live. Your current exhibition, Maui Hunter Fashions, at Christchurch Art Gallery engages with Maori philosophies and knowledge unique to Aotearoa New Zealand. And I hope that today will be an occasion for you to speak about what is that unique relationship and how you've been developing through your PhD and through your practice, concepts that are unique to your island and to the way that you think. Before we get into the conversation, can I ask you, I wanted us to situate ourselves and ask you what you're looking at. What is the room that you're standing in?
Tēnā koutou e tēnei ata. Hello and good morning. E mihi atu ana ki Benjamin. Greetings to you. Ki ngā tangata o ngā hau e whā, aku mihi nunui mō te tautoko o tēnei kaupapa. So my significant acknowledgements to everyone or peoples assembled here from the Four Winds. So yeah, we situating oneself. Excuse me. I'm sitting in my studio right now as I'm talking with you. You're in the evening and I'm in the morning, and I'm looking outside my studio window at a mountain, a very large hill called Tawera. So for Māori, we would situate ourselves in relationship to the environment. Actually, so if talking about self, so to respond to that, I'll say Tawera te mauka, the mountain is Tawera. Rakahuri te awa, the river is Rakahuri, the Ashley River, which is nearby me. Ko ngai tuahiriri te hapu, this is the sub-tribe, a Māori sub-tribe in the South Island that I affiliate to, and ngō ngai tahu te iwi. So this is the tribal group my mother's peoples. Ko arita au. So yeah, my name's Arita Wilkinson, ko whakarākai te mahi toi. The work I do is in the field of Māori personal adornment, I suppose. So the relationship is with the environment and with the land. And because, it's a whakapapa, So the worldview connects people, connects New Zealand Māori to the indigenous landscape here. The term whenua, which means land, also means the umbilical cord. So we're tied, we belong to this land. So Māori are the indigenous people of Aotearoa New Zealand. We can't belong anywhere else. We belong here, if you know what I mean. Through that whenua relationship. Kia ora.
Thank you for that. For the sake of reciprocity, tell you that I'm looking at my kitchen, and I do not have. I don't think I could weave a relational situation the way that you have, of course. But I'd probably say that, you know, that kitchen, that space where I make food every day, is probably the one thing that comes close to a relational definition that has to do with connection to people. And I'm looking at a number of huge pots that I've been using throughout the years. To feed people, which is something that I love to do.
Yeah.
Thanks for giving me this opportunity to do that as well.
And I get, you know, if we were face to face, Benjamin, then after we've greeted each other, we would have a cup of tea and share some food together, because that's also a sacred thing to do between people.
And instead, we're just raising our glass of Coke and.
Yes. I've got my coffee.
So we thought we'd start this this conversation by looking at your recent exhibition, which is just open at Christchurch Art Gallery, Noir Hunter Fashions.
Well, this was relevant to this discussion about situating oneself, and it's the sort of culmination of a number of years work and investigations, I suppose. But at the sort of heart of it is whakapapa, these kind of relationships back to place. Some examples, if you walk into the exhibition space, there is a kind of a boundaried kind of area of Waimakiriri shingle. So that's a plain of riverbed in the space. And above that riverbed area, you can hear the sound of the water. And, that water that has been running for, millennia. So this whakapapa, it doesn't just start and stop with me, but actually this relationship that goes back through the generations, through the legend, back to the earth and the sky and the forming of the planet, there's that water sound running through, kind of connecting us to this sort of time immemorial.
Can I ask, does your invoking of the river, is that a way also connecting to the other Māori people who might connect to that river?
Absolutely, yeah. So the concept of whakapapa is not to exclude. So it's not saying this is just me. It's actually a way for other people to enter the conversation, to find a way to relate. So sitting on my riverbed in my exhibition space, are is a little some workstations, and most recent pieces I've been going back to the use of stone tools and using stone hammers and stone anvils. Queen of the Stone Age. But yeah, this is where we all connect as well. All peoples that walk into this space, we all connect. All our ancestors used these tools once upon a time. For me, the use of the stone tools onto silver and gold is a way to sort of transfer some landmarks onto the surfaces of the fine metals. And I figure that those rivers, or those places on the rivers that I visit, that there is a sort of a very, very located geology, and that sort of geology has a sort of signature on those stone tools, and that signature is then transferred onto the work.
Can you say
just in terms of whakapapa, what it means is that the object that I'm creating is linked back to that river. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I do.
Yeah.
Can you say a few words about the process of choosing these stones? And the fact, because you've isolated, I think, three or four on these plinth in the middle of the,
yep,
the gallery. And sure. These are the tools that you use, right?
So the process would be, firstly, there's three large anvils. So they're just really big, big, huge stones, about maybe 20 kilos each. But they're from specific rivers, and the rivers are the kind of boundaries in this area that I live in. But they're actually ancestral rivers as well for the local iwi, the tribal Māori tribes in this area. So Waimakariri River and the Rakahuri River, and they're braided rivers. So the river beds are really wide and full of shingle, but they might only have they have many sort of parts that kind of braid in and out, or paths that sort of braid in and out. They're just not one single tributary.
Mm-hmm.
So Rakahuri is the main ancestral river for the Ngāti Wahiriri peoples in this area, to whom I affiliate to. But also these rivers are kind of identity markers as well for the people of Christchurch and Canterbury region too. So choosing them is just, what can I carry, or what can I make my husband carry? But they're smooth enough to sort of give me the feet that I want if I'm using them as an anvil.
But some of the writing that I read about your process, some of which coming from you, suggests that, you know, it's not enough to name something for the knowledge to emerge. And it seems to me, and this is where I think, I'm not sure that I got it wrong, but it feels to me that you carrying the stones, or doing the process of tending to those stones, is necessary for that knowledge to emerge. And there's a going with that is important. Does that come close to the reality, or to how you view things?
Certainly, actually being in space, being in just being in place feels really important culturally. And to sort of let the sort of environment kind of flow through you, perhaps you could say. Water is Waimakariri is the cold waters, or the angry waters. But what the term for water is wai, but it also can mean to cry. It can mean remember, to recollect, you know, our memory. It's it has multiple meanings. So the being in place feels quite significant, especially if those places were places that our forefathers walked or worked in. So this exhibition space is actually thinking about nohoaka sites or mahinga kai sites. So nohoanga were sort of seasonal camps for Ngai Tahu, and mahinga kai are sites for customary sites for food gathering and resource gathering. So the exhibition is also thinking about these places where we gathered resources and used manufactured things. So thinking about the importance of being in site is so important that I've brought that site into the art gallery, you could say.
And I think it has to do, at least the exhibition statement suggests that this is a way for you to reconnect with ancestors. And it seems that you're doing there are different ways that you're doing this. You've just explained how relationship to space and to place does that. Choosing a particular site where you walk and pick up stones. But there's something about also redoing the same gestures or gestures similar to what they might have done. Is that correct?
I'm not trying to replicate what was done before, but I am certainly trying to elevate the knowledge of what was of that before knowledge. Does that make sense? Trying to elevate that before knowledge, because I suppose it's a personal mission to highlight and elevate, and through my own process kind of reclaim Mataranga Māori, so Māori knowledge, particularly in the New Zealand applied art and New Zealand contemporary jewellery sort of discourse. So that's one thing. But for myself, I'm doing it for myself because this is part, Māori knowledge is part of my genealogy, part of my whakapapa. So in order to learn more about that, I'm engaging with that material and just, because with, I think we'll just cut a little bit there, Benjamin, but I'll just rephrase that. My practice is about sort of reigniting Mataranga Māori and contemporary jewellery, Māori knowledge for contemporary jewellery, because there hasn't been a lot of people working in that area in the mainstream contemporary jewellery context in New Zealand, but I'm also finding about this for myself because that's part of my genealogy.
You had a response to me in an email when I was telling you I was reading Tui Y. Smith, Decolonizing Methodologies, and you responded, I'm interested in re-indigenizing methodologies. And I think it seems to me that you're speaking about this now.
Yeah.
About a way of reclaiming or reviving a certain form of knowledge in a field which is has been very Western-centric.
Well, that's right. If you look at... In New Zealand, a lot of the I think about objects as containing all the knowledge that took to make them. I might not actually be able to decode that though, right? I might not know the whole story. So I've had to go back and look in museums for Mātauranga Māori around personal adornment, Māori personal adornment. A lot of knowledge has been lost. There is a lot of knowledge that has been written about by non-Māori, but also by Māori. There is also knowledge in sort of more tiatia and waiata, so songs and chants. So we're still learning about, we're still understanding Mātauranga Māori here in New Zealand all the time. So I had to go back to look at museum objects that were in museums that had endured some sort of test of time, or they were collected for certain reasons. So what I mean by that is that a lot of objects have deteriorated naturally and haven't made it, but there are a lot of objects in our collections. And so, but that's kind of not enough. It's not enough to just replicate those forms. I'm sort of interested to do what museums can't do. So I think the most recent sort of investigation was actually looking at some of the tools that my ancestors used to make things, and start and using those tools myself to see what I could do, to see what I could learn from them, you know, what it sort of feels like, you know, what it sort of looks like when I put these two things together, or I use it this particular way. So that's, you know, in that exhibition, there's actually a set of tools. If I just pull that up for you to have a look. And this toolkit, I call it a toolkit. And this toolkit came out of the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology in Cambridge University in the UK. And they all have different provenance.
So just for the audience who's not looking at the image, what Ariza is showing with me is the image of a stainless steel, it seems stainless steel shelf on which is resting a series of stone objects that look like blades, or, you know, thin down sort of stone, and then some bigger ones. Sorry, I just wanted to make that clear.
Yeah. So it's an assemblage of some archaic tools from Aotearoa, New Zealand, from the South Island. These aren't actually the real tools. These are 3D printed metal tools. But 7 objects. There is, for example, a scraper. There is a hammer stone. There's sort of some cutting edges. There's a drill head, a grindstone, and another sort of scraper, or even a burnisher. So as a way of warming those objects back in the MAA, I 3D printed them and then created a tool set for myself to use. Not to skin mower or butchery or anything like that, but I applied them to ceramics, and used them as a tool for mark making, to see what marks they would make, shapes they would make, what kind of cut they would make, what kind of hole was created. And in that regard, gave some attention to those objects and created a work that had a lineage back to those objects, similar to the photogram's work that you've seen in the past. So there's the fact that there is a lineage there that goes back to those first makers, is a way of kind of tributing making making from Aotearoa New Zealand.
And there's different techniques or strategies that you've used for reproducing or relating to these objects that you find in museums. Is the outcome, I think, of a question that you ask yourself with your partner, Mark Adams, when you go to England, which is how to respond to museum findings as artists in a useful and meaningful way. And I've been super interested, the question for me is so crucial. I've been super interested in the way, a very specific way, that you've used to handle or engage with the objects that you found in England when you went there. And I think you went twice. And the sanotypes and photograms are part of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation. Do you want to say a few words? Do you mind? I know it's an older project. There's something very particular about it.
In a meaningful way is kind of interesting. So it's meaningful to myself and Mark as artists, but meaningful to others beyond us. So, for example, making images from taonga Māori, so objects, historical objects that are Māori objects, and I must say particular to the South Island, New Zealand, from our tribal area, becomes meaningful not just for myself nor Mark, but also for other Ngaitahu people who relate to those objects. Right. So it's finding sort of ways to that are sort of elevate, warm that object from that, we call it a taonga, it's a treasured thing, and it's treasured because ancestors have created it and used it, and it's treasured and because of its age. So finding a way that's appropriate for our family, you know, so that it's still, elevation is maintained as a special thing, and if possible, bring something back for the families here, to sort of share that knowledge, or, you know, to share that treasuring with family here.
And you will go through different stages, and if I may, I'll just describe how, you know, the cyanotype, you know, technique works. In your case, accidentally, you're finding the sheets of cyanotype in Cambridge, and you're placing one of the taonga on that sheet, and the light shining onto the object is creating a void on the paper, which is whitish. And the movement of the sun as it moves over the object is creating some kind of a halo around it. And so you end up with a very beautiful monochromatic blue image with a negative, a white negative of the object that was placed on it. And you've used this as a way to inventory or create sort of traces of the objects that you encounter in British museums. And they are the beginning of another then creative process, but there's something in producing an image that is not a negative that you can sort of print many versions of, but just a one-off. Something that is not a mechanical reproduction, that is deliberate. That is, there's something that you've written about how that is important to you in the process.
I think so. A few things culturally feel really powerful in terms of that, using those photogram processes, whether they're silver bromide photograms done in the dark or cyanotype blueprints which are done in the sun, and that the taonga object is really active in the image making, so that it actually touches the paper. Taonga object is sitting on top of the light sensitive paper, so that's the first one. So you can't make a cyanotype or a silver bromide photogram without the object. And touch itself is really highly charged, it's really important. Touching, keeping the objects warm, is culturally regarded. It's the sort of notion of the heirloom is really tied up with taongatuku iho. You know, it's really tied up with touch and handling and telling stories and keeping the sort of stories and objects sort of tied and told through time. So we've been really fortunate to be able to either take objects out into the sun. There's something that also feels really powerful about that, to take a cultural treasure out of a museum storeroom and take it out into the sun and warm it. Let it be outside and breathe the fresh air and sort of be amongst the world of the living for a while. Or we get to darken funny little storerooms and offices with polythene and plunge sort of museum, precious museum objects into the dark.
I feel that.
Like images.
I think you're amused at sort of how scandalous this sounds, you know, when thinking about this sort of British Museum, that to take things out and warm it with your hands, it goes against what we, you know, the sort of tenet of preservation and which, you know, is premised on not touching, that is sort of key to these collections. And you're saying, you know, I need to warm it to activate it.
We have to touch it. Mm. Actually, that is the opposite, you see. So indigenizing would be to warm, to touch, to handle, to, you know, take, to be lively and give the object some sort of time and attention for a little while. Yeah.
There's a concept, I think, that I'd like to hear about, which is ahua, or A-H-U-A.
Oh, okay. Yeah, ahua. So it can mean ahua, A-H-U-A. It can mean the form of something, but it could also mean the semblance of something. So that there might be an essence, for Māori, that an essence, if you believe objects have an essence, then that essence can transfer. And it can be for in a good way or a bad way, actually. So if I am to take, make a photogram of something, in Te Ao Māori world, there is something from that original object that transfers as well. So that's another reason why I'm thinking about how I treat that image responsibly as well, because it should be looked after just as well as that original object. For Māori, they're sort of similar, they're the same potentially. So another example is in the meeting houses here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and you've got the carvings of ancestors. Well, they're actually spoken to and they're talked to like they are actually the ancestors themselves. Yeah. And so it's just something I need to be aware of when I'm working in this territory.
And so that essentially creates obligations towards the images. And I think I remember you telling me that these images that you brought back from England and those that you produced afterwards, first of all, were not to be sold. You know, they're not, you know, for selling. And also that they, if I remember well, and they required a certain form of care.
I just felt that I needed to take care of those objects as they would be taken care of here in New Zealand. That I would, so I'm trying to be careful around with food and drink around them, for example. Mm-hmm. That some of them, depending on what the content are, so if they're of sort of, because I don't know what the original objects were used for. They might have some cultural restrictions around them, for example. They might be sort of quite sacred. And so I just feel that, yeah, I'm just going to just to be a good caretaker of those things. And it doesn't feel right to sell, commodify them and put them into private collections. You know, maybe they might go into a public collection one day. I haven't learnt all I need to know from those objects yet. So they're still with me, and I'll take care of them, and I've got to figure out who I hand them on to and how. I haven't quite worked that one out yet.
So it seems that in the process, you know, you've described, you know, several different processes, one that has to do with the stone and the reproduction of the tools by 3D printing, and now we've discussed the image making based on objects that you found in England and in New Zealand. The subject of this talk, or the conversation, is how we learn with objects, and you've sort of, you know, you've put some breadcrumbs on the way for me to try to follow. How would you describe this process of learning with the object? Feel free to flip back the question to me and say that you want another question if you're not happy with
it. I mean, I know how learning sort of happens in the studio, for example, you know, through sort of educative, you know, social science kind of processes, you know, that just, you know, through experimentation and reflection and research and sort of synthesizing kind of information and all those other three things, you know, you might end up with something that you create in the studio, and then you sort of cycle through those things again and just sort of develop and develop and develop. That's one way of learning in the studio. For me, I don't know, it's a sort of a personal journey. So I just looking through museum objects, I'm kind of learning about sort of some of our histories here in New Zealand. So when we're tracing Taonga Māori and international museums, I have to ask, you know, how did they get there? And you know, Mark's really interested in that too, because we're both sort of unpacking this in different ways. I'm looking I'm interested in looking at these at Taonga Māori through sort of Māori lens, and finding a way to sort of relate to that work and kind of warm that work and bring something back. For whānau back home, and he's really interested in how that work got there in the first place, because that's actually more to do with sort of his history. So you know, I've got some images of Māori bones and bone midden in the exhibition in Christchurch. Well, it's really fascinating. These are museum directors in New Zealand, Aotearoa New Zealand, particularly Canterbury Museum in Christchurch and Otago Museum in Dunedin. And these museum directors are swapping out material over the globe, including Munich and Berlin, and in this case, the British Museum and Leeds Museum. And so we're sort of following the taonga around the world and finding where it sort of ends up and kind of making connections back for that taonga. So an example is when I was in Berlin, I was looking at some small little bits of Kokowai red ochre that were in the museum store there, and they knew nothing. The curators, I mean, they were just these little bits of red rock, but I could actually relate some stories about, you know, I knew where they'd came from. You know, I had visited those places, and I could tell some little narratives around that ochre for those curators. In fact, I left them a recording, which I had done a few years prior, about that material, but from it was a cultural narrative. And so I could actually leave something behind as well that helped enhance that cultural material for the caretakers of that material. So really enjoy sort of finding out about, finding out about our sort of my history and our sort of history. Because in the end, it's another sort of whakapapa story, really. It's another genealogical story that relates back to my connection to place. Those Moa bones, actually, the ones from Leeds actually come from the hills not far from where I live. And they're butchery bones, so these are Moa bones that, early Māori had butchered, and they were also producing objects from. So yeah, I'm just fine. So what is it like, a one sort of lifetime sort of detective story?
I can see, it was interesting in the presentation of the project you conducted with Mark, how differently you expressed your interest in the project, and he was concerned about not fucking with Taonga. I think the language is something like this, and that has to do with the fact that these treasures and the fact that they're in England has to do with the colonial sort of past, and the fact they were plundered and then brought back. You instead are interested in creating these genealogies and remembrance. I was more surprised by your interest in the circulation between museums, and something you just mentioned, the fact that there's this constant swapping going on. And that seems to be slightly different from genealogy. It's something else that you're trying to understand. Can you tell me what it is?
The power of taonga. Mm-hmm. Perhaps. This is the part of our colonial story, I suppose, of New Zealand. And our sort of part in those sort of stories of enlightenment of other countries. The story of Māori as being a well-researched cultural group, like other Indigenous peoples, well-researched, because we're other. Fascinating kind of curiosities at one point in time. Why? It's just a question, why did this cultural material end up in another place that is not its home? How did it get there?
And so you're saying that the current circulation of these treasures between museums is still part of this sort of ongoing othering of the Maori people?
I don't know if there's a current circulation. That might have moved towards more sort of contemporary cultural production, though. But certainly, it's actually really interesting how little international collections know about their collections, some of their collections. So it's through those relationships that collections can be enhanced, I suppose, and collections can be reconnected with their source communities. Mm. I think that's really important in 2020.
And I heard this argument developed by a German scholar, Clémentine Delisse, and actually her book, The Metabolic Museum, was suggested to me by Elle Louis from New Zealand. And And in this book, Delis, who was the director of a museum in Frankfurt, ethnographic museum, describes how she invited artists to help give meaning back to the enormous holdings of the museum that had been kept under wraps, and sometimes kept under wraps under precedence that if it was brought out in the open, in the sun, it would crumble, or it would be toxic, or something would happen. And so there was some kind of a concerted effort to remove it from the public eye. And so this director, did a lot of work around, what could happen if you invited artists like you and who generously then give an interpretation or perhaps traces a genealogy that the curators, the caretakers are not able to trace.
That's right. And also I think that we can sort of demonstrate other ways of kind of knowing as well. So that the sort of record of understanding these cultural objects it's not just the museum sort of authoritative kind of voice on the matter. That there are other voices, other experts who can speak about these objects or unpack or unravel or I don't know what the words are actually. There are other sort of ways of knowing. Around these objects that perhaps more culturally appropriate to those source communities.
It seems certainly like a way to honor these objects differently. And also it seems to me that you're describing a collective effort of giving meaning to objects, which reminds me of something that I've seen, I think, only in New Zealand, which is Te Papa's campaign to invite people into the museum and ask them, do you know what this is? Can you help us actually find out? And this has been for me an eye opener in terms of how knowledge or how an institution such as Te Papa can involve the community and the people into deciphering and giving meaning, giving names sometimes to people and objects. I don't think I've seen that in Europe, but I may not know of every instance. And there's
certainly there's a whole lot of cultural experts that don't work for museums and don't hold those kind of Western qualifications, who do actually carry the knowledge or enough knowledge to sort of expand our understanding of things.
The knowledge that you're describing, and I'm thinking back of what you said 5 minutes ago about the difference between the sort of knowledge that emerges from studio work and experimentation. Yeah. And this sort of the knowledge that emerges from you going around the world and tracing genealogies. It seems that there's a few notable differences between the two. And one of them is that you can create a hypothesis in the studio and say, if I do this, I think this will happen. And then you can verify that it actually has happened or not. Instead, I think your continuous engagements with Maori artifacts and the way that you've tended to them doesn't lead to that sort of, now I know what I didn't know before. It seems to be tentative and ongoing. In a way that is exciting and frustrating at the same time.
Yeah, you could say that. You're sort of walking a little bit of a knife edge sometimes in the territory of taonga. But yeah, absolutely. There's still a lot of learning to come. And that's where those sort of opportunities where others can gather and critique or support or whatever, like at the opening, that you actually start learning more about those things from other people. Because I was was actually one of my elders who really kind of hit it home that what I was doing was whakapapa. So whakapapa is a term for genealogy, but it actually means to layer up, to layer up. So in that exhibition, and in most of the, I'd say all of the exhibitions I'm doing, there's a whole lot of layers that relate, and all those layers kind of end, sort of, all those layers are sort of linking up my culture production today to culture production from the past. That idea of ahua, the shape or form, that silhouette form that a photogram might produce, and then to create an object, thinking, using kind of that silhouette form, that's whakapapa. And it was actually my auntie who really kind of nailed it, named it for me. I kind of knew it, but I didn't know it. And to hear her say that really made that kind of concrete. And it's an appropriate thing to do, because whakapapa is a system so that we do remember, so that we keep those forms and some of that knowledge going. So even though I'm not replicating forms that the old people made, the forms I'm making kind of have a narrative that relates. So all I'm saying is that you don't end up knowing answers, you end up with more questions and just really opening up a conversation. So the conversation of that exhibition was around mahinga kai, these sites of production, and so it's like a contemporary mahinga kai. It's a space that where I'm working, and I'm using local clays. You know, I'm using ochre from down south. I'm using these ancestral tools, you know, in this site, and really simply just saying, this is part of a continuum here.
Yeah. And it seems to be non-accumulative. So what strikes me is when you speak about your discoveries and your work, is that you never speak of it in terms of accumulation of knowledge. It seems that you need to repeat the genealogy and recite it again every time, and it's going to be retold to you, and you're going to add to it, and that is the way that it is passed on, as opposed to solidified and then sort of added up as you would, you know, maybe in a more Western sort of way of looking at things.
I think that's how it's working for me, at least. It certainly is a cultural system, and if you were to, there are, for example, oral narratives and oral kind of systems that are repetitive, that, and you learn those, but through learning those, you can kind of recite to support the point you're trying to make. I've certainly, when you are looking over sort of a practice, it's that way too, that you kind of spiral into context of investigation, and something from that might lead to the next thing, might lead to the next thing, and then you might end up going back. So it's not linear, by all means. It's not linear, it's more relational. But I think that one other process that's important, though, for the learning is also the return of knowledge. So not only finding out about the world, the Māori world, but also returning knowledge back, and by doing so, that's more of a conversation, and there is more to sort of be gained, because it doesn't just belong to me, kind of thing.
And one of the questions that I have for the different speakers, you know, the five conversations that I'm having is, because everyone is sort of looking at different ways to think about learning with objects, and some of these ways have to do with self, a journey of the self, you know, learning through making or learning through engaging with these genealogies. The question then becomes, or one of the questions that emerges, is that of transmission. If the knowledge is equal to the footsteps that you made going to these different places and coming back, how can that ever be transmitted to someone else if they don't make the same journey or their own?
Yeah, well, you asked me earlier about being a role model, and I don't relate to that. It's kind of uncomfortable, but it's not really where I want to be. I think it's really about opening up spaces for other people. So, yes, sharing what you know, you know, sharing your experiences, and then maybe that's the example, so that others can find their own way too, you know. Yeah. So the pathway is, we're not saying, the pathway is creativity, perhaps. Mm. But innovation is, what I found was that when I looked, for example, when I looked at sort of some of our Māori adornments in New Zealand, that there are examples where there is a sort of a repetitive narrative, but there are also examples of innovation. So we can follow others' footsteps, but we can also go our own way too, because that's actually, we've always done that. Yeah, that's human nature.
Sure. We have maybe another 5 minutes to this conversation. We can go on forever, but there is 5 minutes to the hour. And I was wondering whether there's something, Arita, that you felt we hadn't discussed, that you'd like to discuss. I mean, I'd sent you a huge email with many, many terms and many things, but is there something that you'd like to add to this conversation?
I'm just a bit overwhelmed. I can't think. I didn't really have an agenda.
No.
Just for my own self, sort of whakapapa is right up there, and it's sort of looking at sort of the layers around things and relationships, so, and not sort of a linear kind of approach, but more sort of relational sideways approach. This sort of links to that, might link to that, or the relationships might come later. An investigation doesn't kind of get dropped. It just kind of gets kind of enhanced down the line. I feel very privileged. I love the sort of personal growth that the creative process sort of brings me and brings others. I'm so lucky that I can kind of share that journey. Can't think of anything else, Benjamin.
That works for me. thank you for being so generous early in the morning for you, late at night for me, and explaining or working me through some of the ideas. And there's we just scratch on the surface of some of the aspects of your process. I want to thank Vincent Rieu, who's working on the technique. I want to thank Dambijou Alot, who's allowing us to have this conversation. And most of all, I want to thank you, Rita, for taking the time and being so generous. It's been a long time since we last spoke, and the last time I came to the studio, you taught me a few good lessons, and one of them is to shut up and listen and to look at things through your eyes. And I still have this as one of the important moments in my first trip to New Zealand. So I wanted to thank you for that as well, once again, because I have often done that, but it's been a big moment for me. So thanks for that.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Benjamin. Really lovely to connect again with you too. And yeah, just take care of yourself and your family and everybody who's listening. Take care.
Vous êtes bien sur Radio Bâle, la radio des Beaux-Arts de Paris, live. Et on reprend ces discussions à 11h.